Welcome to Pod Summarizer, the way to summarize your favorite podcasts. Welcome to Powerful JRE. In this episode, the hosts dive into a lighthearted conversation filled with personal anecdotes, discussing everything from childhood injuries to the quirks of vanity. Their banter reveals unexpected insights and humorous stories that will keep you engaged. Let's begin.
I'm too vain. That's exactly right. I look back and I think, oh, those headphones are pushing up my hair. Isn't that sad?
That's you so shave sad. Your head.
That's sad.
You never look back if you do.
Yeah.
Oh, it's the greatest thing in the world. Yeah. It's freedom.
I have a big dent here from when a meteorite landed on me when I was a kid.
A meteorite. Yeah. Oh, funny story.
I know.
Got plenty of cuts on my head. I got them all over the place.
Well, you're looking pretty unscarred.
Oh, the back of my head. I have one when I was a little kid. It's pretty big. That one of these cranes that lifts up sewer pipes, those big concrete pipes, bang me off the back of the head. Yeah.
That's not good.
Grayed out, went to the hospital.
Were you a different person before that experience?
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to talk to my mom. Hmm. I was always a little
this
wild.
This could be of autobiographical significance. You know?
Oh, there's definitely a lot of head trauma.
Hmm. Were you knocked out?
My personality. No. Okay. I stayed conscious, but I got
that's
close.
That's the big predictor.
I got gray. I grayed out that I came back to. I didn't completely go unconscious. So Jamie went golfing this weekend with O.J. Simpson's golf clubs.
Uh-oh.
Not with O.J. He's not here.
You should be exercised. That would be the next step.
Jamie bought O.J. Simpson's golf clubs after
this is like a childhood dream?
No, they were just for sale. I saw them for sale. I said, why not? They came in. I wanted some big grips.
Yeah.
They weren't that expensive.
A couple of my friends. What did Shane get? Shane got a bunch of stuff,
right?
I talked
him into buying some stuff, yeah.
He got like scarves and
ties. He bought a bunch of ties.
I think scarves, too.
Okay. He bought a trophy.
A trophy?
And a Bill Clinton signed photo.
And he spent thousands of dollars.
What was this? This some sort of O.J. Simpson auction?
Yeah, it was like an estate sale, yeah.
Yeah.
I see.
You know, he's
see.
Dead now, so you can get his stuff.
Right, for nothing. Pennies on the dollar.
Well, it's, I mean, only people like Jamie and Shane are dumb enough to buy. It's like for a goof. It's one of those things like you're either getting it for a goof or you're a very dark person.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Right.
I wouldn't want to own it, even for a goof. Like, if I found out O.J. played pool, I wouldn't want his cue.
Was there cues? No, there wasn't. There was a weird notebook that Robert Kardashian had, like, handwritten stuff to him.
Blood splattered.
I was like,
on
whoa, it. That might be interesting. But
it's taking a vicious turn, Joe, already.
Yeah, that's a dark story.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you only know the surface of it.
Well, it's dark in both ways. It's also dark in planted evidence. You know, there was blood at the scene of the crime that had preservative in it, allegedly, supposedly, according to Robert Kardashian. And according to, I believe, the forensic scientists when they analyzed it. It matched OJ's blood, but they had to draw blood from OJ in order to determine whether or not it was his blood that was at the scene of the crime. And some of the blood found at the scene of the crime had that preservative in it that they use. They were sloppy in the 90s, you know.
Compared to now.
Well, there was no DNA evidence back then. You know, there's always going to be a certain percentage of cops that just want to convict somebody regardless of the evidence. And if they're, you know, in their mind, they believe someone's guilty, they'll do whatever they can, including planting evidence, I guess. At least that's allegedly. I don't think he did it. I definitely think he did it. But I also think the cops planted evidence, which is probably at least partially why he got off, you know. Mm-hmm. I think the big reason why he got off was Rodney King, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Have you gone into the whole George Floyd story at all? Have you ever, like, looked at, like, what they actually did to him? It's a combination of things. Like, what the cop did was horrible, but also he was dying. Mm-hmm. You know, like, mm-hmm. most people probably, like, if they did that to you, you probably would have lived. Mm-hmm. You know, that guy had an enlarged heart.
That was my understanding
of
it.
He was fucked up. But that cop did lean on his neck, which is always interesting to see people trying to minimize that. You know, I'm always like, you got to be able to just say what it is.
Well, that situation can be ugly in a multitude of ways.
Yes.
Right. That's when things get, well, That's when it's very difficult to pick your moral pathway forward. All your choices are not good.
Yes, right? Which is oftentimes the case when it comes to conflicts, right?
Yes.
Conflicts are very complicated, and people want it to be binary. They want there to be a good guy and a bad guy, and that's oftentimes not really the case.
Well, it's hard to organize yourself for combat unless you are quite convinced that you're the good guy. Mm-hmm. So there's a default to that dichotomy that's a necessary part of, well, even standing your own ground, right? Because otherwise you get demoralized.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suppose people, well, when they're threatened, they default to a simple narrative, and because that's, you can't defend yourself. In some ways, it's very hard to defend yourself, especially physically or militarily, without a pretty cut and dried narrative.
As we delve deeper into the complexities of conflict, it's crucial to consider how clarity and moral judgment plays a pivotal role in high-stakes situations.
Well, especially like military operatives, you know, you have to have a very, your life and the people that you're with, their life depends on you not having any confusion about whether it's morally correct to be doing what you're doing. That's why they like to break it down to kill bad dudes, you know, kill bad dudes.
Right.
Real simple. Let's go. They tell us what to do, we do it. Which is what you want to stay alive, you want your teammates to stay alive, that's what you have to do.
Yeah, well, you never know when doubt will cause a fraction of a second difference in reaction time.
Oh, yeah. That's always the thing with physical altercations with people, too. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. oftentimes people get sucked into these things where they're not sure whether to act or not act, and that's when they get in trouble.
Right.
You know.
Right. That's probably true in life. You don't want to oversimplify things, too, but once you've made a decision, well, that's when it's necessary to put doubts behind you, because otherwise you just act in half measures.
Yeah, and oftentimes you have to have done the wrong thing before, like failed to act or hesitated to act, and it cost you. And then you have to learn that lesson. It's very difficult to like know that without experiencing mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to have failed to act and then realize, oh, I should have done something there.
Yeah, well, I think that's partly, too, one of the things that I often faced in my clinical practice and with the students that I mentored was this confusion about acting. I don't know what to do, so what should I do? Well, nothing. I'll wait around until I figure out what to do. It's like, no, you should put together a bad plan and you should implement it. Because even if you fail in the implementation, you'll gather information, and then you can rectify the plan. And so staying in that malaise until you know what to do makes you get older and more miserable, and you gather no information along the way. A bad plan is a good idea. Best, you know, any plan is better than none. That's a good rule of thumb. And a bad plan can be incrementally improved with experience.
Right. He who hesitates is lost.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really difficult for young people. I think more so today than ever at any time in history, because the distractions are so many and they're so engrossing. You know, mm-hmm. if you get out of high school, you don't know what to do, and then you start playing video games and you're on social media, a day can slip by like that.
Yeah.
A day becomes a week, becomes a month, becomes a year, and before you know it, you're 30.
Yeah, right.
And you
that's
haven't
for
done
sure.
shit.
Yeah.
And that's really common. That's really common today. And I don't think we can ignore those factors, the factors of just engrossing distractions.
Yeah, well, and the algorithms optimize for short-term attention.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a weird thing, eh? Because you could imagine that you would want a machine that offers you what you want. Right, because you want ads that are targeted to you, because you want to see a bunch of ads that aren't relevant to you now and then, because maybe you'll learn something. And content, well, why not have a machine shovel the same sort of things that you are interested in at you?
Yes.
That's a kind of curation. The problem comes, and we haven't figured this out at all technically and probably not psychologically, the problem comes in time frame, right? Because there's a big difference between what you might be interested in if you were diligently striving towards a long-term goal that required conscientiousness, and what's going to attract your attention right now, this moment.
Right.
And the thing about the algorithms is that they maximize for short-term attention. And that's so basically they're actually optimizing for hedonism.
Yeah.
And then you might say, well, so what? Because you're getting what you want. Well, the problem with short-term impulsive hedonism is it doesn't play out well over any reasonable time span.
Yeah. Right?
So that's why you have to mature, which is painful and annoying, but absolutely necessary and much better than the alternative. The alternative is exactly what – that's Peter Pan, right?
Yeah.
30-year-old, I still haven't grown up, and
yeah,
I'm a little past my shelf life now, too.
I think people are afraid of losing fun. They think that when you grow up, you lose fun. But it's silly. It's not true. You can grow up and still have fun. You know, you just have to – you have to have discipline and prioritize mm-hmm. your time. Mm-hmm. You know, like,
well, that's why Christ says to people that they have to become as little children, mm-hmm. not stay. Right? You have to rediscover that.
Rediscover the joy of it.
As we shift our focus, let's explore how these themes of maturity and joy manifest in real life interactions, particularly in the context of public engagement.
Was then, that the first time she had ever gone on stage in front of, you do enormous crowds.
Yeah, well, so first of all, she did that, and then we replaced the business discussion, because we were just doing an update about the family, you know, and so she'd do that. We replaced that with ads, and then she started to talk. She talked about the rules, say, in 12 Rules for Life, or some of the religious things I've been dealing with lately, and she'd relate that to something in her own life. And then she does the Q&A at the end of the lecture. And part of that was just, she was along with me, and part of that was Michaela was introducing me for a while and then had to go back to her work. And so we slotted Tammy in because it seemed like a good business decision. But one of the things we figured out very quickly that was really a shock to us was that people really liked, especially the Q&As, because what people will offer their questions electronically on this platform called Slido, which is a very good platform for such things. And then Tammy would, they could upvote the questions, and then Tammy would sort them and ask me questions kind of from the top down that were thematically relevant to the lecture that I had given. But we found very quickly that people really liked that because they hadn't seen a couple engage in civilized discussion ever. Seriously.
Like, yeah, it was really, a lot of that out there.
It was really shocking, Joe. Like, you know, I was shocked when I first started touring by how demoralized people were. Like, that was really striking and painful to see that on such a mass scale. And then also to see how little encouragement it took to have a really major effect. I mean, there's a positive aspect to that too, but there's also a tragic aspect. It's like, you mean you just need to have some encouragement and that was enough and you never got that, like even once? That's rough when you see that in thousands of people.
Right.
And it was the same thing. We found it was the same thing with regards to seeing a functional couple, at least even that model. Because, you know, Tammy asked me questions and she thinks about the questions. And then sometimes she comments, but not that much. But she actually listens to the answers and she wants to hear the answer. And right. So, and that dynamic is being played out on stage, and people found that very heartening. And well, that shows you, well, you said, you know, yourself, and this is why I brought it up, because you had the example from your stepfather and your mom
yeah.
of this long-term relationship that worked. I mean, how the hell do you orient yourself if you,
right.
if you haven't seen that anywhere?
Right. You consider relationships just like all the bad ones, and like you're going to be burdened and locked into that. Did you ever see that video where Alec Baldwin and his wife are on the red carpet and they're being interviewed and they're asking them questions and the wife starts talking and Alex chimes in about something and she said, "You're not talking, I'm talking. When I'm talking, you're not talking." Mm-hmm. On camera. Mm-hmm. And you watch this, you're like, yo. Mm-hmm. That's what everyone's scared of.
Right.
That's
right.
What
definitely.
You want to talk
competition.
About like tyranny. Mm-hmm. The tyranny of being trapped in a relationship like that is like, and sometimes one person is so overbearing that the other person just sort of submits to it, right? And then you're just like, I don't want to fight. I don't want to deal
yeah.
with this. I don't want to deal with this. And so then you're just trapped, and this person's insulting you and humiliating you publicly. That was the case with Phil Hartman. I got to see that. We would all go, like, we went to a party once, and I remember she was talking about ex-boyfriends that she loves pickup trucks because her ex-boyfriends had pickup trucks and they would climb into the back of these pickup trucks. And I was like, what the fuck? But she was doing it on purpose to, like, make him squirm and make him uncomfortable. And she would say things like talk about how he's old. Oh, he's old. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't like to do anything. And it was just public humiliation in front of friends you're in this, like, arena where he can't say anything.
Yeah.
He can't just go, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, why are you talking to me like that? Mm-hmm. Like, why are we doing this? He can't do that because he's public and he's out with us.
As we delve deeper into Phil's life, it's essential to consider how these public dynamics shaped his personal choices and the image he felt compelled to maintain.
Maybe he should do it anyways.
Probably should do it anyways.
Yeah, probably.
But we're all out, and, you know, Phil was all about, like, appearances, how
things looked. Right, right.
One of the things that he was afraid of with getting married was that he was just starting to break into films, and a lot of the films that he was doing were very, like, family-friendly films, and it helped that he was a family man. You know, if he was
right, so he had an act he had to sustain too.
He had an image, right? And this was critical in Hollywood. Like, they had ideas of who you were. Okay, you're a family man. Okay, good, good, good. And so if you have this radical change in your life where no longer you're a family man, and if you want to be honest about it and you want to say I was in a toxic relationship and some of it was me and some of it was her and this is what happened, like, whoa, now you're opening up the world to this big can of worms. Better to keep that can sealed.
Yeah, well, it's generally better not to have your fights in public, and it's certainly better, you know, I mean thinking about this commandment to honor your mother and father, and I've been thinking about what that means. I read this book called Angelus Ashes by Frank McCourt, and Frank had a really alcoholic father, like an Irish alcoholic father back
good
in
time.
The 40s. Oh, yeah. And he drank every cent the family had, and they lived in terrible poverty.
What a scary
and his
disease.
Sister died, and, like, it was rough. But he said his father was often sober in the morning, and he established a relationship with, like, good morning sober father and kind of put alcoholic, drunken nighttime father in a different bin, and he could get the benefit of having a father in consequence of that. And that honoring, that's also something that you want to do within a marriage, right? Because your wife is your friend and your lover, but she's also your wife, and you're her husband, and that means that a part of keeping that marriage working is honor, and part of the honor is that you don't do that sort of thing in public.
Right. No, right, because, you don't humiliate each
and
other.
And
you
that's
in public.
Well, that's also in some ways independent. In a way, it's independent of who your wife or husband is. It's like, you know, you can imagine two people fighting in public and one of them or both of them really deserving to have that fight as people. But then to keep the marriage intact, you have to remember, well, this is my wife. She's not just my friend. She's not just someone I know. She's my wife. And we shouldn't be doing primate dominance hierarchy maneuvering in public. We shouldn't be competing for power because that's going to destroy the marriage.
Yeah.
And so that's part of that honoring, I think, is to remember the role and to keep it, well, sacred is really right, sacrosanct.
Here's another one. Don't ever insult each other, even though you want to. Like, you want to, like, be mean sometimes. Like, people get mean to you. You want to be mean back. I don't do that with my friends. So I don't do that with anyone else. I don't want to do that. That's why I don't do it online. I don't get involved in these, like, hissy pissy fits online, particularly on Twitter. I just don't think
it's the prime place for such things.
That's all it is. First of all, again, as someone who looks at everyone like a child or like a baby, I'm not angry that people do that. I understand the appeal of it. If I was 15 and Twitter was around, I would be tweeting at every fucking celebrity saying, you're a loser, jump in front of a bus. I would say things just to try to get a reaction out of them. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of kids do. I think a lot of people don't feel like they have a voice, and one way to be heard is to be insulting, and one way to hurt is to be negative. If you look at the majority of discourse on social media in regards to hot button issues, it's disrespectful. It's contentious. It's shitty and insulting. And I've decided, like, over time in my life to not do that. I don't want to do that. I'm not interested. I'm not interested in that. I'm not interested in that kind of conflict. Like, I see real conflict all the time. as an MMA commentator, you know, I see the most violent legal conflict other than war all the time. Mm. That's conflict. That's like real conflict and resolution and, you know, purposeful, agreed upon conflict. Like regular, like back and forth and salt. Wouldn't it be better to figure out what you agree and disagree on and why and talk? Hmm. Like, why can't we all figure out how to do that? That should be a discipline you learn at an early age. Most of the issues that people have, if the person comes at you insulting and aggressive, either that person is ignorant or they're playing a game, okay? And the game is to get your emotions up, to get you reactive, and to be reacting to them instead of acting. Mm. The game is like if someone's hyper-aggressive in a fight. The game is to put you on the defensive so that they don't – like the best defense is a good offense. You learn that early on in fighting. So you learn that you can be very offensive and then the person never has a chance to get their game going. That's the case with conversations too. So this is like – there's a gamesmanship to this kind of communication where it's not just communicating. It's communicating, but it's essentially intellectual one-upsmanship and sparring. You're sparring. You're scoring points. You're trying to dunk on each other.
As we delve deeper into the complexities of communication, it's essential to recognize the emotional toll that these confrontations can take on individuals.
And I get that. I've done that before. I've engaged in it. It's never satisfying. It always feels gross. Even if you win, it's gross. Mm-hmm. Like I said this before, like even like publicly things that I felt like I had to do, like the Carlos Mencia conflict that I had way back in 2007 where I accused him of stealing material and it became this viral video and then a bunch of other comedians jumped in and we all agreed there was a real problem. It was a real problem because he was very famous and he was being protected by these agencies who were profiting off of him being famous. They didn't want that train to stop. I still, to this day, wonder if I would ever do that again because the negativity that came my way from people that were fans of his was so, it's so overwhelming if you're paying attention to it. It's like, what did I open up? Like, ugh. Even though I knew it was necessary. Like, what? And that is also why people are negative because they want to stop you from engaging in conflict that's going to hurt them. You know, so they try to hurt you as much as possible. So you're like hesitant to do it. I don't want to wade into those waters. Ooh, it's dangerous, filled with sharks.
Well, you could imagine maybe, I think this is worth delving into in some depth. You could imagine that there's various ways of attaining status, renown, reputation. Status isn't exactly the right word because reputation is better because you can have a reputation that you deserve. Right. And so people do work for reputation and all things considered, that's a good thing.
Earned reputation.
Earned
is the
reputation.
Best.
Yeah. Earned reputation. Earned valid reputation.
Or someone's truly unique. Whether Jordan, that guy, that's a unique human being and that's a real reputation.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Kind.
Okay.
That's
so,
what people want.
Right. Right. And it's also there isn't anything more valuable that you can have than that. Not even close. This is why, by the way, this is very cool. It's a bit of an aside, but it's worth bringing up. In the Gospels, Christ tells people to store up treasure in heaven where it doesn't rust, where the thieves can't steal it. That's reputational treasure, right? So the idea is that if you conduct yourself impeccably, you'll develop a storehouse of reputation that will withstand all catastrophe. Mm. There's no place you can put your wealth that's more effective than that. It's the least violatable place. And that's right. It's right.
Right.
And so, but the problem is, and this is a really tricky problem, and you're touching on it, is that the reputation game can be gamed. Okay, so when your reputation rises, your serotonin levels rise. And that makes you less sensitive to negative emotion and more sensitive to positive emotion. So that's a really good deal.
Mm.
And what that also means is that there's a high psychological benefit to status increase, reputational increase, and a real cost to reputational decrease. So that's partly why people don't like losing face, for example,
right,
because their emotions dysregulate. Okay, so now the best way to play that game is to establish a genuine reputation. And the best way to do that, you've done this, by the way. I figured out this year in my lectures that I'm always trying to answer a question on stage. So that's a quest. And I'm bringing the audience along on a quest. And it's a real quest because I'm actually trying to figure something out. And I do that in real time. And that's a very different game. That's a very different conversational game than the status battle game.
Yes.
Right? Because I could come on here. I don't know if it would work. But I could come on here and I could try to show that I was smarter than Joe Rogan. Now, I've watched you, and that's a very difficult thing to pull off. But hypothetically, that could be my aim, and I could play gotcha questions, and I could lead you into places.
The problem is that wouldn't work because I'm willing to accept that you're smarter than me. First of all, I talk to a lot of people that are smarter than me, and I like it. It's enjoyable. I don't ever feel uncomfortable talking to people that are smarter than me.
Yeah.
I want to know some things that they can tell me on certain things. I want to educate myself. See how their mind works. I want to be blown away. I don't want to compete with them intellectually. There's times in my life where I would have fallen into that trap.
As we shift gears, let's explore how these dynamics influence our understanding of the world around us.
Well, and you want to incentivize people to pay attention to their local environment. And you do that in part by ensuring that they're not living so close to the edge of catastrophe that they can only think about today.
Right.
And if you start from the mindset that, can I tell you another story?
Sure.
Okay.
You tell me all the stories. You don't have to ask questions.
All right. This is a really cool story.
Okay.
This is how to set the world right, this story. So I've been traveling around lecturing about my book, and I wrote a chapter on Abraham in that book. And Abraham is the father of, in principle, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, right? He's the father of nations. That's how the story goes. So when God comes to Abraham in a very particular way, it's one of the ways God is characterized in the Old Testament. So this is like a definition of God, right? It's not a testament to God. It's a definition of what God is. Okay, so Abraham, he doesn't hear anything about God till he's like 70. And he's already living in privileged paradise because his father and his mother are rich. And so he doesn't have to lift a finger. If life is about having your needs met, Abraham's got it covered. And so he lives like a satiated infant till he's 70. And then a voice comes to him and it says, you are required by the God of your ancestors to leave your zone of comfort, to leave the wealth of your father, to leave your nation, to leave your language, to go out into the world and have your terrible adventure. And if you do that, so now imagine that's the call to adventure. If you do that, these things will happen. This is the covenant that God makes to the Abrahamic people. It's so cool. I just talked to Brett Weinstein about this from an evolutionary biological perspective on the road because I wanted him to evaluate the story I'm going to tell you from an evolutionary perspective. So God is the voice that says to Abraham, if you follow the call of adventure, you'll be a blessing to yourself. So that's the meaning of life, right? To have the adventure. You'll do this in a way...
Blessing to yourself.
Because the adventure is compelling. Responsible romantic adventure is the most compelling pathway, right? And if it's intense enough, it justifies the suffering, right? It's a reason to get up in the morning, even if you're in pain. Okay, then he says, there's another thing that'll happen too, which is that your name will become known among your people for valid reasons. So that's that genuine reputation that we talked about. So if you follow the pattern of adventure properly, you'll be a blessing to yourself and your name will become known among your people for valid reasons. So that's a good deal. You'll do this in a way that will maximize the probability that you'll establish something of permanence or even eternal permanence. So Abraham is offered, if he accepts the call and makes the proper sacrifices along the way, God says your descendants will outnumber the stars. So he establishes the pattern of fatherhood that best propagates down the generations, which is the same as following the pathway of adventure. Then he says, you'll do this in a way that will make sure no one can stand before you, right? So that if you adhere to that adventurous spirit and you propagate it, all enemies will either be converted into friends or flee before you. And then you'll do it in a way that brings abundance to everyone. And so now, Matt, this is the question I'd ask Brett. So imagine this. So imagine that we have an instinct in us, or a divine voice, I don't care which of those you use, an instinct within us that calls us to develop. right, that puts us on the edge. And that's not the same as looking for infantile satiation or the gratification of our needs. It's genuinely this call to expand yourself and to be on the edge and to develop. That if you did that, to follow that instinct, then you'd be a blessing to yourself. Your name would become known among your people. You'd establish something of permanent significance. No one could stand before you, and it would bring abundance to everyone. Right? And then in the Abrahamic story, what happens is that as Abraham accepts that, goes out in the world, and then he has a series of adventures, each of which requires a more complete sacrifice.
As we shift our focus from the journey of Abraham to the transformative experiences of Moses, let's explore how these pivotal moments shape the essence of leadership.
Quest for new information. Okay, so let me can I tell you a story about that?
Please.
All right, so this is the story that comes up at the beginning of Moses when he turns into a leader. So it's about how you turn into a leader. Okay, so he's already killed a man and he's left Egypt because of it. So now he's in this land called Midian, and he goes there and he chases some ruffians away from a well for these two girls who are drawing water. And they go and tell their father, and he says to them, bring this young man home to have dinner. So he does, and then he gets married to them. And then he becomes a shepherd. And this is crucial because the shepherd's an image that runs through the biblical corpus, right? Well, shepherds at that time lived by themselves in the wilderness on their wits, and they kept the wolves and the lions at bay with primitive weapons. So these were tough guys. And they cared for the most vulnerable. So a shepherd is an image of optimized ordinary masculinity. You can take care of yourself, you can keep the monsters at bay, and you attend to the most vulnerable. So Moses has got that. He's a shepherd. He's a successful shepherd. So now he's out there one day wandering around Mount Sinai. And Mount Sinai, or Mount Horeb, that's the place where heaven and earth touch. So that's where the messengers of the divine descend to earth. And so he's out there and something attracts his attention, makes him curious. That's the burning bush. It's not a forest fire. It's not something you can't ignore. It's something alive because that's a bush. A tree is a symbol of life. And it's burning because things that are alive burn, right? That's metabolism. And an intensification of that, like a psychedelic intensification of that, that's what the burning bush is. And that's what glimmers to Moses. And he steps off the beaten track, right, to investigate what drives his curiosity. And so then he goes off the beaten track and he starts to delve deeply into the mysteries of the burning bush. And at some point he realizes he's on sacred ground. He takes off his shoes. That's a symbol of willingness to transform identity, because shoes signify identity, right? They're part of your costume, your working man's costume. And so then he continues to commune with the burning bush. He gets deeper and deeper into something. He makes himself a specialist by following what compels him and delving deeply into it. And when he gets deep enough into it, to the bottom, the voice of eternity speaks to him and says, you're now no longer who you were. You're now a leader. You have to go back to your people. You have to stand up against the tyrant. You have to tell the slaves that they need to leave their tyranny and their slavery and serve me in the wilderness. And you have to do that now. And Moses says, I can't because I can't speak. I'm slow of tongue. And God says, basically, that's your problem. And with me on your side, we can sort that out. And don't you have a brother, Aaron? And can't he speak? It's like, bring him along for the ride. And so that's when Moses becomes a leader, right? And so that's the pattern. It's like ordinary masculinity. Those are the dwarves that Snow White serves before she meets the prince, by the way, the ordinary masculine, right? So, but, and that, and those dwarves protect her from the evil queen that wants to suppress her by feeding her a poisoned apple. So Snow White has to learn to serve the ordinary man before she can find a prince. Yeah, something Disney missed completely in the last story. So what's the pattern? Well, you discipline yourself so you become a shepherd, and then you follow what compels you off the path. Then you take it seriously and get to the bottom of it, and then that transforms you. And thus transformed, you can face the tyrant. Mm. You can specify the promised land properly, and you can lead the slaves across chaos and blood, that's the Red Sea, and then through the desert, right? And so you said, you know, you said two things. You said that the good fighters have learned to integrate their civilized side. Otherwise, they don't get to be great, and that they continue the pathway of self-improvement, right? They continue to pursue what's calling to them. That's another definition of God in the Old Testament, by the way. What calls to you?
As we delve deeper into the journey of self-discovery and transformation, let's explore how these principles resonate within the broader context of spirituality and sacrifice.
Yeah,
so
clearly.
Okay, so now the question is, what constitutes, now you know you have to sacrifice. So sacrifice becomes the foundation of the state, not power, not hedonism, it's sacrifice. And then that motif is played out through the whole Bible, and that's what culminates in the New Testament, right? Total sacrifice as the foundation of the community. And that's right. And like, I don't know what sense to make out of the metaphysics of the religious realm, you know, because that's beyond me and everyone. The world's a strange place, and we could leave it at that. But the idea that, see, Christ is the exemplar of voluntary self-sacrifice, right? Won't turn to power, won't deviate from his course, faces the worst of all possible deaths, descends to hell itself. That's the pattern of life lived with no reserve. And that's the foundation of the free state. That's right. I tried that on Brett, hey? He told me when we first met on the tour that he felt that the biblical narratives were anachronistic, you know, that they were written in a time that was no longer relevant to us. But he decided by the end of our 3 days together that if you got to the core of the message, it's alive, right? That's the living spirit inside the bush, you might say.
Right.
And that it's, so here's even the weirder thing. So imagine, it's pretty obvious that Christ is a symbol of voluntary self-sacrifice, right? I don't think it doesn't really come as a shock to anyone. But the weird thing is, you know, we put that symbol at the center of our churches and at the centers of our towns for 2,000 years, not really knowing why. And the reason is that voluntary self-sacrifice is the foundation of the integrated psyche and the stable, productive, and abundant community. And that's right. It's right. And so, well, it's been exciting to have the opportunity over the last 9 months to go talk to people about that, because I've talked to about 150,000 people, I guess, public lectures.
That, to me, is one of the most fascinating aspects of Christianity. Regardless of whether or not you think logically these things took place, logically these stories are a completely accurate depiction of exactly that one. If you follow the principles, it's incredibly beneficial to your spiritual life as a person. Like you.
Well, that's a kind of interesting proof, isn't it?
Because yeah.
It means that
there's truth in it.
Well, there's certainly. The spirit that makes, what would you say? The spirit of truth that makes life more abundant. That's exactly right. And these are weird stories because the way they're true is very sophisticated. They're true always. And that's different than a story about the past. Mm-hmm. Like the truest story is always happening. And the story of Moses is exactly like that. Like the pattern of leadership development that's embedded in the Exodus story, that is how leaders develop, if they're real leaders. And their temptation is power, but that's not their motivation. That's their temptation, right? That's a very important distinction. And that's always the case with leaders. And if they fall prey to the temptation of power, no matter what their accomplishments, they're not going to complete the task.
Right.
And so there's a cool element at the end of that story too, you know, when Moses, just before Moses dies, he picks a scout from each tribe, 12 tribes, and he sends them to Canaan, which is the future. That's a good way of thinking about it. It's the potential place we could reside where everything was worked out, the land of milk and honey. He sends 12 scouts there. And 10 of them come back and say, they tell a fear story. Say, it's insurmountable, the challenges that lie ahead of us. There's no way we can master this. We should have never crossed the desert. We should have stayed under the thumbs of the tyrants. We should have never tried to be anything more than slaves, because now we're doomed. And two of them say, no, if we maintain our upward orientation and our covenant, nothing can stand in our way. We can make the deserts bloom. Moses dies, those two scouts, and so do all the Israelites who are convinced by the unfaithful scouts, and the scouts die, and the two people who go on to the promised land are Caleb and Joshua, and they lead the Israelites, the faithful Israelites, into the promised land. Those are the people who have the courage to confront the future in a faithful and, what would you say, faithful, hopeful, and courageous manner. They're the inheritors of the future. Caleb, Joshua. Joshua's name is the same as Christ's name. It's the same name. And that's not fluke, right? That's one of those echoes or precursors to the story.
As we reflect on the journey of Caleb and Joshua, it's essential to explore the ethos that guided them into the promised land.
There's an ethos that leads you into the promised land. And what's the ethos? The spirit of voluntary self-sacrifice. You know, you give up something for a social relationship. Of course, you give up being primary, right? You do the same thing at the social level. And when you do that, it integrates you and it sets the world straight. And that's built into the biblical story. It's right at its core. So
pause that thought. Yep. I'm going to use the restroom. We'll come back.
Yep.
We're back.
So it's great fun to explain these things to people on the tour because it sorts them out.
Well, it's very fascinating.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And the fact that these stories have existed for so long is so interesting. You know, that's where it gets really weird.
Yeah. Well, they've adapted to the contours of our memory and our imagination.
Yeah.
So you find them compelling and they stick to your memory. So I'm going to tell you what else I'm up to, okay?
What are you up to?
Well, the first thing I want to do is thank you. So we launched Peterson Academy in September, and we talked about it, and it's been a stunning success. We have 40,000 students.
That's amazing.
We think we're the most rapidly capitalized, we're one of the most rapidly capitalized companies ever, especially with our degree of investment, because we run a lean show. We have great professors. We have a great social media site. We had to kick 10 people off it. We have 15,000 active users. 10 people were dragging it sideways.
What were they doing?
They were causing trouble, Joe.
Sociopaths.
They were causing trouble. Yeah. Well, or immature, or out for, or didn't know how to conduct themselves. Or,
yeah.
That's all it took. And now everyone is sharing ideas. And Mick, my daughter and her husband, they keep a close eye on this.
That's great.
We have secured funding to the point where we are dropping the price from $5.99 to $3.99 a year as of today. Right. So that should make it accessible to a lot more people. And we're even more convinced than we were that this has to be the future of higher education. So when we were doing our due diligence for the fundraising, we discovered that 40% of courses at university are now online. And we've investigated some of those courses. Many of them are PowerPoint presentations, and that's all. And so that's the university experience for full tuition. And we literally have the best professors in the world and unmatched production quality. So, and we're filling in the social element too, because we want people to be able to meet. The social media platform does that. It's a very positive platform. We've already had our first couple announce themselves, which was quite fun. And we're going to do in-person events. Our first plan, we're going to do a cruise.
Can I ask you this?
Yeah.
What has your journey been like to go from relative obscurity as a professor in Toronto to becoming this person who you are now, sort of a worldwide educator outside of the standard system of academia, but also subject to intense international scrutiny, character distortions, complete what they've done to change your position, something like, you are probably the most intentionally misrepresented person I know. Intentionally misrepresented. You see it with a lot of other people too, but with you, it's malicious. You know, I've seen it. But yet you have this desire inside of you to spread information and to educate
and learn
and learn.
I'm learning on the stage.
What has it been like? How old were you when I first met you? It was like 2015, right? Somewhere around
10 years ago, 53. Yeah.
You were just encountering notoriety, just encountering attention and what all the trappings that come with that. What has that been like? Like navigating that? It's very unusual that a person becomes world famous, you know, at 50.
For ideas.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
As we shift our focus, let's explore the complexities of empathy and its impact on political discourse.
Right. And the left is unbelievably susceptible to that because the left is full of empathic people.
Right.
And so those who parasitize empathy have a field day on the left.
Right, right. The left is generally thought to be more educated, more compassionate, kinder, looking out for marginalized people. That's part of the ethics of it all.
The ethic is pretty straightforward. Anything that cries is a baby. It's like, no, some things that cry are monsters.
Ooh.
Right, right. Well, let's take the case of Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish Prime Minister, the previous Scottish Prime Minister. Any man who wants to can be a woman. It's like, okay, any man. You mean any man, do you? Yeah. Have you encountered the nightmare men? Oh, they don't exist. They're all victims. Yeah. You just bloody well wait till you encounter one. You'll change your story very rapidly. And for the naive and sheltered empaths of the radical left, they're either psychopaths, so they're wolves in sheep clothing, or they're people that are so naive that the Red Riding Hood's grandmother can definitely have his way with them.
Yes, that's literally something that I use as an example in my Netflix special. I said that I think there are people that feel like they're trapped in a woman's body, and then there's also people that are out of their fucking mind. They're crazy, and that
but
what I pointed out all throughout history, when you wanted to make like a killer in a movie scarier, you put him in a dress, like Norman Bates in Psycho, Silence of the Lambs, and I'd use the Big Bad Wolf. I'm like, it's literally a wolf dressed up like a woman. Like, that's literally what it is. And they've somehow or another completely abandoned this one aspect of masculinity that's one of the more terrifying, is the predatory pervert. And they've given the predatory pervert a privileged position.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And that's
Eve's sin, by the way.
One of the craziest things about it is they've completely abandoned the idea of the pedophile
and the monster
and the sexual pervert, the attacker, the assaulter, the person who, when you give a guy, you say, all you have to do is say you're a woman. Now you have access to whatever women's spaces. Yeah. All the women's spaces. You could victimize them. You could fight them. You could beat them in sports. You could dominate them in all games. It's bizarre. Bizarre that no one's caught on to that. And that's
for sure.
That's the weirder, that's the more cult-like and even, you could say, religious aspect of leftist thinking.
It's an original sin. Eve clutches the serpent to her breast. Ooh. It's like, that's a serpent.
Right.
It's poison. Yeah. You don't get to love it.
Right.
Right. It's a monster.
Right.
Right.
It's a guy wearing a dress with an erection in the women's room.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. Or worse.
Yeah. Or worse.
Or worse.
Yeah. Or a lot worse. Yeah.
Well, right. And you know, there are no shortage of naive people who've never really encountered a monster and have no imagination for it.
But there's also people that are willing to justify the monster's behavior because the monster is a part of a protected class now.
Yeah, well, that's part of that.
Which is crazy.
Well, the cluster B types use proclamation of victimization to parasitize. That's part of their clinical pathology.
And they're
so ubiquitous. Poor me. I get to do anything.
And they're so common.
Yeah.
That's what's really crazy. And why is it that academia is overwhelmed by people like this? Is it because it's vulnerable to parasites?
Sure, why not? It was a storehouse of unguarded value. You know?
Without any religious principles.
Well, also, there's that too. And with no real gatekeepers.
Right.
Like the parasite problem is a very deep problem. So I can even give you an example of that. This is a hard one, but I'll try. In the Pinocchio movie, this also happens in Jonah, the story of Jonah. Remember, Geppetto ends up in a whale. It's like, what the hell? There's no explanation for that in the story. It's like he's out looking for Pinocchio, and now he's in a whale. Well, a whale is a giant carcass, right? And so when something dies, its spirit, what would you say? Its spirit is then embedded in a carcass. That's a good way of thinking about it. That's why Pinocchio has to go into the belly of the whale to free Geppetto and finish his transformation, is that when things deteriorate, right, you have these carcasses lying around with their dead spirits. The spirit of what gave rise to them is still inside there. And the job is to go into the carcass and to revitalize the spirit that produced it and not to parasitize it.
As we delve deeper into these themes, let's explore the contrasting dynamics of compassion and discernment in relationships.
Wow.
Yeah, right. And so I've thought that through for a long time. It's like, well, what's the female relationship? Because that's a crucial one. The female-dominated disciplines are the most woke by far.
Why?
And so I think it's because of that basic ethos of compassion. All who cry are babies. Well, look, that's the right default for women.
Yeah.
You know, like wise women. My wife is one of these women. She was a very good mother. She never thought adult men were babies. Like, one of the things that's quite striking about my wife is that if you're a useless man, she doesn't feel sorry for you. You're not a baby. Now, she's really good at taking care of babies. And so she got to be, she's discriminating in her empathy. And we're in a situation now where people think that indiscriminate empathy is a virtue. That's Eve's sin.
Right.
See, Eve, literally, Eve wants to put the feminine ethos at the top of the hierarchy of value. That replaces God, right? And that causes the fall. And then Adam, he's such a cuck. That's exactly it, is that he goes along with her. He doesn't stand up and tell her that maybe she shouldn't be listening to poisonous serpents. He doesn't. He consumes with her what she delivers so that she'll be his friend, because you know how useful men like that are. Yeah. And then when the fall happens, he complains to God that God made Eve and cursed him with her. Mm. That's the story. So it's not just women. And we got to get this straight. Women with their drive towards indiscriminate compassion so that even the serpents are their children. It's men, too, who won't say. They always say, yes, dear, whatever you want. Yes,
dear.
Weak men who enable who don't help the women set boundaries. Now, you got to do that as a man, you know, like when you and your wife have a baby, for the first 9 months, every time the baby cries, it's right. Right? You respond to a baby's cries as if it's right 100% of the time, because human infants are so dependent and utterly unable to fend for themselves. So that sets up a very powerful feminine dynamic. It's like, if it cries, take care of it. Okay, so what are the men for? It's like, if it cries, take care of it, except that. That's a false cry. And you see that with kids. They'll start playing with that by the time they're 9 or 10 months old, right?
Right,
yes,
right.
Of course. And so you differentiate. It's like, oh, no, that's not a baby. That's a snake. Well, are you sure it's not a baby? It's like, nope, snake, for sure. Snake, poisonous snake, in fact. Right. Well, I'm feeling pretty sorry for it. It's like, save your compassion for the truly needy.
Right.
And leave the snakes to me. Right. And Adam doesn't do that.
Is it a function of a society that's almost, I don't want to say too successful and empathetic, and there's too much abundance that you have more of this crying?
Look, no, but you have more parasitical behavior.
Right.
Why? Well, everyone's got pretty comfortable because we've been in a high trust society for a long time. It's like, oh, everybody's trustworthy. It's like, no, a few people in a few countries are trustworthy most of the time, and that's really hard.
Right.
Right. And there's stringent preconditions. Right. So everyone's trustworthy. And now there's all these piles of wealth lying around everywhere. It's like parasite dream, especially when it's unguarded.
Yeah.
And so it's enabled by the women and unguarded by the men.
Mm.
And both are at fault, right? And that you see that in the Genesis account, too. It's like Eve clutches the serpent to her breast, but Adam fails to help her distinguish.
Plenty of these parasitic men as well.
That's it for today's summary. To stay up to date with more summaries and news, follow us on X and Instagram, and visit our website, www.podsummarizer.xyz. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, or complaints about the content displayed, please do not hesitate to write to us at info@podsummarizer.xyz. Thank you for listening.